This is the epic one with Daleks, and most of the aliens from Mission to the Unknown, and Egyptians, and political intrigue, and fratricide, and the breaking of the fourth wall. It's called The Daleks Master Plan. Here we go.
We're embarking on a voyage all through time and all through space,
encountering Daleks, Thalen, Ood, and the Cybertronic race.
Santorans look like taters, and Silurians all have wonky scales.
And the Doctor has a TARDIS, we're reviewing all his tales.
Who back when?
Reviewing all of who there is.
Who back when?
Subscribe and rate on iTunes, please.
Episode by episode, we're trudging down this temporal road. Come join us on this odyssey. What other choice could there be than
who back when?
Who back when?
Hello, ladies and gentlemen of podcast land, and welcome to Who Back When, a Doctor Who podcast. I am Ponkin, and this is episode C021, The Daleks Master Plan. Holy freaking Jesus balls. With the possible exception of The Trial of a Time Lord, this is the longest Doctor Who story made so far. It's a 12-episode arc. I am, once again, actually, I should say this up front, in case you're just tuning in. Hello, thank you for tuning in. I mentioned this in the last classic review. There are about 20, I guess there are about 19 serials left now that are not entirely intact, as in the footage has been lost. And for this little stint of lost episodes, I'm going to be doing the reviews as solo casts, with a few possible exceptions. There may be a couple of mystery guests popping around Punk Plaza to record. I'm not going to say anything just yet, you're just going to have to wait and see. But yes, this one I'm doing on my own, and as I said, it's a 12-episode arc. 12 episodes that need to get the Who Back When treatment. 9 of those 12 are missing. Only 3 are actually intact. There are only 3 recovered ones. And I am sitting here in my flat by myself. I have a dirty vodka martini at my side at the ready, because how else am I going to get through this serial on my own? Needless to say, I am going to lose my mind. But before we go into all that, before we even launch into a B-scow, why am I saying we? It's just me and our Dalek intern, 343, aka Sheila. That's right, we got a female Dalek on staff now. That's an equal opportunities podcast. Before we launch into all of that jazz, it's time for another Who Back When international shout out. This one goes out to Fabiola. Oh my god, Fab, you are fantastic, ladies and gentlemen. Fabiola sent in an amazing email. Such an endearing and heartwarming message. To me, she starts it off, dear Ponkin, it's addressed to me. I take your point, it's to the podcast. Holy moly, what a fantastic message. Fabiola, I hope you don't mind. I'm going to read out a couple of lines from your message to share with the ladies and gentlemen of podcast land, because they have to understand what an amazing human being you are. Fabiola writes, dear Ponkin, that's me. I don't know if you still remember me. I wrote in last year. Yeah, I do remember you, Fab. How could I possibly forget? She goes on, I just wanted to express several things. First, happy anniversary. Thank you very much. I can't believe it's already been a year. I congratulate you and your marvelous co-host, the legendary Flapjack, the fabulous JD, and the cool, calm, and collected Rawmeister, for a splendid job in keeping the show going, and look forward to so many more podcast reviews to come. Secretly and anxiously hoping to reach the Tom Baker years. He is the Doctor I grew up with, and of course, my favourite one. Fabiola, I grew up watching Tom Baker as well. He's my favourite too. Okay, she goes on. Second, I wish I could express all my thanks and appreciation again to you and your wonderful compadres for really making my day every time I listen to your podcast and reminding me that there are people out there who care about Doctor Who as much, or should I say even more than I do. It would be too long to express adequately all that this series means to me, going back to my childhood. I will just say that there is something I find very endearing about the series, and your podcast, and listening to your reviews, and other listeners' reviews, just makes me very happy, while always broadening my knowledge with cool facts and trivia. Fabiola, I'm so pleased to hear that, and ladies and gentlemen of podcast land, so should you be. You should be... I'm imagining that you're all basically smiling right now, because there is so much heart and soul in this email. And don't worry, Fabiola, I'm not going to read out the whole thing, but she mentions in her email that she listens to the podcast on her commute, which is from one country to another. So whichever country you work / live in, this is an international Who Back When shout out. You have qualified, Fabiola. I am so pleased that you're listening. Thank you so much for your email. Ladies and gentlemen of podcast land, please, what are you waiting for? Follow Fabiola on Twitter and hear all of the mesmerizingly, amazingly wonderful thoughts that she has to share with the world. You can follow follow her. She is at FabiCab1. That's Fab, as in fabulous. I, as in I think you should follow her. Cab, as in I carbed. Believe that you're not following her already. And one, as in she is numero uno. Oh my god, follow her. Fabiola, thank you again. Let's jump into a B-Scow. The Doctor, Stephen and Katarina arrive on Kemble, where they team up with space security agent Brett Vian and learn of the titular Dalek master plan to take over the universe. Turns out the Daleks have teamed up with not just the aliens that we encountered in the Dalek cutaway, Mission to the Unknown, but also the Guardian of the Solar System himself, our solar system one presumes, and have constructed a time destructor powered by a core of solid terranium. So when Doc and Co. steal the core and speed off in the TARDIS, a race across time and space ensues with Daleks and the Guardian in hot pursuit. End of B-Scow. You are welcome. Okie dokie, I'm going to take a sip of my martini, and then we're going to jump into this. Holy moly, 12 episodes. We might be here a while. Sip. Oh, that's refreshing. All right, okay, and here we go. Episode 1, The Nightmare Begins. Doc, Stephen, and Katarina are in the TARDIS, and Steve Rooney still has a bit of a jippy tummy. Doc says they need to land somewhere to rid Steve of the poison in his system. Poison? When did that happen? At the end of the Mythmakers, he was injured in a sword fight with some Trojan chap, not with a cobra. Someone who hasn't changed at all, though, is Katarina, who's still utterly oblivious to her own kidnapping, so guess what I've got it down as in my notes? Blam! Cut to, one assumes, the planet Kemble that we last encountered in Mission to the Unknown, where two agents of the Space Security Service, Brett and Kurt, are trying to space call for some space reinforcements on a space radio that, I shit you not, ladies and gentlemen, has what written on it? That's right, space. Actor trivia alert, though I suspect the more perceptive among you already know this. Who plays Brett? Glad you asked. It's Nicholas Courtney, who would later portray Brigadier Alistair Gordon Lethbridge Stewart. The blurb, or tagline rather, of their little dialogue could be summarized as, "The whole solar system is at stake." Why do I say this? Okay, I say this because, and this, yeah, obviously as with, well, maybe not obviously, but as with the previous Dalek stories, this was largely written by Terry Nation. Some of the episodes, well, I would say actually 50-50, it was, half of it was written by Terry Nation, the other half was written by the Spoonmeister himself, Dennis Spooner, after ideas by Terry Nation. That's actually how it's credited, or how he's credited. And Terry Nation, I'm not entirely sure, but I think maybe someone should have sat him down before he actually started writing this thing and just talked him through the difference between solar system, galaxy, and universe, because those three terms seem to be tossed around interchangeably. Anyway, whatever. Then we space cut to a control room. The Central Communications Control Room, according to the audiobook, where two dudes with alopecia and black turtlenecks are silently pushing buttons, and where we meet two humans, Rowan and Lysa, bickering over what to watch on telly. Essentially, Lysa, or Lyson actually, I'm not entirely sure. She's a dudette who's apparently a big fan of someone named Mavic Chen. We're going to get back to him a little bit later on. He's otherwise referred to as the Guardian of the Solar System. And Rowan's just some dudaroon who wants to see the big game. Should mention, actually, I've already kind of hinted at this now. I watched the Loose Cannon Productions recon of this, and I got the audiobook version of it. Actually combines Mission to the Unknown and the whole Dalek Master Plan in one set. It's narrated by Peter Purvis, and it features essentially most of the audio from the TV serial. It is worth noting that I'm not entirely sure if the order is identical in the audiobook compared to, in the audiobook and the TV serial. I think perhaps in the audiobook sometimes the scenes got mixed up a little bit. Not sort of mixed up in the sense of, oh my god, I thought I was talking about this, but now I realize I'm talking about something else. It's not like that. More like they actually bundled them together in a way more reasonably to further the plot. But it has all the audio from the TV serial, whatever's actually still intact, and whatever action we would otherwise see on screen, and that is in the recon present just as captions. In the audiobook, Peter Purvis explains what goes on. He narrates the whole thing. So it's really, really cool. It's very, very good. It'll take you about 5.5 hours to listen to the whole thing. Entirely worth it. Totally freaking worth it. Okay. But yeah, and Loose Cannon Productions, props to those guys. They did a marvelous job of reconstructing this thing. Anyway, all right, fine. Let's go on. In the recon, we see a flashing light in the control room that isn't explained at all and that we assume is just random. But in the audiobook, Peter Purvis tells us that this is to signal there's an incoming call and that it's overlooked. What? What kind of lackadaisical operation are they running at the Central Communications Control Room? Why have they put their one purpose in life, the universe, and bureaucracy on on silence. Isn't there at least a vibrate mode? And by the way, they even know to expect a call from Brett and Kurt, who are on an official mission to find Mark Corey, but they just blatantly don't give a damn. What effing ever. They settle on the news, and there's an interview with Mavic Chen, so obviously Lysa's really pleased. Okay, so first off, Mavic Chen, he looks like a photo negative of a Vulcan doing blackface. And secondly, he starts by casually mentioning that some mineral agreement with the Fourth Galaxy was more complicated than expected. Yeah, no shit, Mavic. It's full of Jarwin Chiquitas, after all. That's a hint, hint, check out Galaxy 4. Thirdly, he's like this major politician, right? He's the politician of the solar system, in fact, considering his title anyway, and the interview seems to basically just be about his upcoming holiday. To where? He won't say. For how long? The journalist doesn't appear to know, or even think to ask. But he'll be available on space email, right? Nope. That's fine, I think. Probably not much happening in the solar system that could require a politician's input. Column 4, we're still on Mavic Chen here. Column 4. He drops a reference to a peace treaty that was signed by Lord knows whom in the year 3975. And he says that now in the year 4000, thanks for that, Mavic, he hopes peace will continue. Why would you jinx it like that? This isn't a ceremony of some sort. This isn't an anniversary celebration. He doesn't even have to bring it up at all. Why aren't his parting words just, so long, galactic MFers, I'm off to bob around in ultraspace to ignore my duties as guardian of the solar system indefinitely? Ugh, whatever. The dudette, Lysa, thinks they have a missed call. Apparently there's no way of checking, by the way. This is the future. Yeah. Technology, not so great in the future. And it transpires now, in the recon as well, that because of their bickering, they did miss a call. Namely, the space call for space reinforcements. So, I'm sorry, space agents on Kemble, but you're boned. Meanwhile, they're getting pretty worried. Or Kurt is, anyway. We're now on Kemble. You have to keep up with me a little bit. Okay, so, Kurt is really worried. His leg is injured, so when Brett tells him they should keep moving, Kurt basically just tells him to shove it. We also get the first mention of Varga plans here. Brett says he'll Indiana Jones the first Varga that dares F with him. And we also get a mention of Mark Corey. Kurt reckons he turned into a Varga. Little does he know, though, Corey was lasered to balls by the Daleks in Mission to the Unknown. Anyway. Whoop whoop. First anyway of the episode. Alright, I think anyway. I've said it again. Alright. Okie dokie. I'm already self-conscious about my anyways. Here we go. Kurt knows he's just slowing them down with his gammy leg or whatever, so he threatens to laser Brett unless he leaves on his own, which he does. It's a touching moment, really, which leads to actual video footage. So now we get to see Brett just walking around in the jungle and on Kemble, and the look on his face when he realizes what his compadre has done here, like essentially just sacrificed himself. Like, no, listen, I'm slowing you down. You need to leave. If you stay here, I will shoot you, so you have no choice but to leave. It's really heroic. And oh yeah, by the way, so far everything has just been still images. So now we see Kurt stumbling around the forest with his gammy leg. He encounters Dalek and he's lasered to shit. And we're back to stills again. So now Brett drops his transmitter and is about to lose hope when, bada bing, the TARDIS materializes before his very eyes. He hides as Doc and Oblivious step out into the forest, and we learn that Oblivious knows how to open and close the TARDIS door. But she doesn't know what a key is because she's from freaking Troy, and keys are too high-tech for her to wrap her medulla oblongata around. Ugh. Sorry for ending on a preposition there. But even so, Doc asks her to go back inside and lock herself in, while he goes looking for medicine for Steve, which he does. This makes no sense. For two reasons. Number one, seriously, don't leave her unattended in there with a practically unconscious Steve Meister. For all that Doc knows, the moment he closes the door behind her, or the moment she closes the door behind her, rather, she lit a fucking bonfire in there, or sacrificed the TARDIS control to the gods. He has no idea. Numero dos. What medicine? Does he know what poison is currently coursing through the Steve Meister? No. Did he take a blood sample? I don't think so. And even if he had, he's in a fucking alien jungle. Is he expecting to find an aloe plant that he can massage into Steve's wound, or a pharmacy? This is pretty dumb. Also, why doesn't he have a first aid kit in the TARDIS? Surely just popping a plaster on him must be more helpful than, well, Katarina, aka Oblivious. In fact, in a moment, the Doc will see a city in the distance and say it's a strange place to put a city. But that he'll get help there. If it's such a strange place, why even exit? I mean, why would you assume that you're going to find something that will remedy Steve's condition? Never mind, we must speed ahead, otherwise this will be a 7-hour podcast. yada yada yada, he sees the city, then Brett points a blaster at him. He takes the key off the dock and we cut back to the TARDIS, where Oblivious annoyingly slowly introduces herself to a temporarily conscious Steve. Then he passes out again, and Brett steps in, alone, starts spouting some unholy bullshit about the Doctor telling him to enter and take the TARDIS to Earth. Then he unknowingly turns on the scanner, and Steve regains consciousness again and sees the Doc arrive on the scanner. Let's have a soundbite here. A Doctor soundbite. Soundbite? Soundbite!
Well now, if it's brain, or brawn, rather, versus brain, I've got you beaten from the start, young man.
Well phrased, Doctor. So Steve then knocks out Brett, and the Doc sees a massive spaceship fly overhead. Yada yada yada, Brett is now stuck in some weird chair made of flesh magnets or whatever, while Doc's outside encountering Corey's body and the discarded reel from C-019, Mission to the Unknown. And then we have some gorgeous and perfectly intact video footage of the ship landing at Dalek HQ. It is beautiful. If nothing else, if you don't have the patience to watch the whole recon, check out all the work with the miniatures. It's really quite stunning. And then Brett has his save the cat moment. Cheers, how did this get made, for teaching me that term. By giving Oblivious some pills that will cure the Steve Meister. Blammo! Surprise, surprise, out of the giant ship now steps Mavic Chen, and is greeted by the Daleks as another one of their accomplices. Doc sees all of this, hurries back, only to find the TARDIS doors open and a couple of motorized dustbins outside. Blam! One down, 11 more to go. Oh, God. All right. Episode 2, Day of Armageddon. This, by the way, completely intact. You can watch Episode 2, Day of Armageddon. I can't remember, on TARDIS Wiki, it actually says how they came about recovering the individual episodes. There are 3 episodes that are intact, but I cannot remember. So check out TARDIS Wikia for that. Anyway, Day of Armageddon. FYI, not of tremendous significance, but worth noting that the following pissed me off to no end. Actually, 2 things. Number 1, the audiobook recap of the cliffhanger has Peter Purvis start off on a subject-verb disagreement. He goes, "The doors is ajar." Plural, singular. Sloppy Pete, very sloppy. Number 2, the last video ep ended with 3 Daleks approaching the open TARDIS doors, but now there are only 2 Daleks there and the doors appear shut. Whatevs. The Daleks report to Control about the TARDIS, say they're going to hunt down the intruders and that Operation Inferno is to be executed following an abbreviated countdown, whatever that means. Operation Inferno is a great name, by the way, even though it's not very secretive. Like, they could have called it Operation Lollipop and potential spies would never have figured it out. Mark Corey could have picked up something about it on the ether and just gone, oh, this is just some clandestine gorilla sweet factory. No, no worries. By the same token, though, now that I think about it, I reckon every Dalek plan, regardless of how mastery it is, and regardless of its degree of malice, has a dramatic, violent name. Like, hey, 347, you will repaint this cupboard. I obey. What will we call this project? We will call it Operation Kill All Kittens! crack myself up. It is screenshot time, though. In Dalek HQ, Chen is writing something in longhand, as one does in the future, and we learn that in the future, people hold pens like total bozos. He also appears to write in a zigzag, so when one line finishes on the right, he just jumps down immediately to the next line, and then starts writing to the left. Which, actually, I gotta say, it's pretty cool. Blam. Enter a guy with shrubberies for hands, introducing himself as the leader of the 5th Galaxy, and basically saying, sorry we didn't make it to the Dalek powwow, but this wouldn't have worked without our input, so you know, no biggie. Then Chen explains he's there despite his role as Guardian of the Solar System, because he wants even more power. What I think is this, like, this other dude, Mr. Shrubbery, the Knight of Ni, outranks Chen, right? Because he's in charge of a whole galaxy, except it's like an outer galaxy, like the burbs of the universe. While, let's face it, in the Doctor Who universe, I'm betting that since everyone speaks English, the Milky Way has probably unanimously across the world been declared Galaxy One. That makes sense, I think. No matter. Then we get a Dalek cutscene where the Supreme tells 347 and 348 that Chen needs to be guarded, and later, when Operation Inferno has been completed, he and all the others are to be killed. So never trust a Dalek, guys. Never. In the jungle, meanwhile, Steve Meister comes to, and he and Oblivious are joined by the Doctor, and they update each other on the proceedings. Turns out Brett Hammer assumed the Daleks could enter the TARDIS and got them all to disembark it, but actually they would have been completely safe in there. Oh yeah, and we learn, once again, it is confirmed, it is the year 4000. Okay. What? In Mission to the Unknown, we were told the Dalek invasion of Earth occurred 1,000 years ago. In this one, in this serial, spoiler alert, it is confirmed that the invasion in fact took place in the year 2157, which would be freaking 1,843 years earlier, not 1,000 years ago. Is this Terry Nation's trademark space maths? God damn it! Okay, let's move on. Meanwhile, Brett is guerrilla diving up to some Daleks and sees them activate some honest-to-God flamethrowers in place of their standard-issue plungers, or pyro flames, as they call it. I'm guessing in contrast to water flames, or maybe pyro icicles. And this is mega badass. If I'd been a kid in, when was it said? Like 1966? 65 or 66? I think 66. If I'd been a kid then, and I'd seen this, I'd have become either a bedwetter, or an agoraphobic. Or both. Anyway, then we get a shouting match between Brett Hammer, Steve Meister, and Doc, as they're now all assembled, and Doc wants to head to the TARDIS. Steve says to stay put, and Brett just wants them to shut up so he can think of a way to warn Earth.
Now you listen to me, young man. I am in charge of this.
Stop!
Will you shut up?
The Daleks are torching the jungle now to trap them, and to head to where they're least likely to find them, the gang heads to the Dalek City. Meanwhile, the six or seven evil allies, who look more like they're in the tens now, by the way, let's call them the Coalition of Kick-Ass, that's what I've got them down as in my notes, they assemble for a meeting, and the Knight of Nia, it turns out, hasn't arrived yet, and the Dalek commander goes, he has outgrown his usefulness, or something to that effect. What the shit, Dalek? For all you know, he's having a tinkle, or will be right with you, or something, he had to water himself. Regardless, they literally just formed this alliance. Then you arrive late for one evening and you deserve to be exterminated? That is ridiculous. Like, these working conditions are by no means acceptable. Okay, so now Brett recognizes Chen's spaceship outside and goes, What a dick! He's the guardian of the solar system! And so they plan to steal that spaceship and pilot it back to Earth. Enter the Knight of Nia, stage left, Mr. Shrubbery Face. Turns out all of his extremities are made out of shrubberies, by the way. We get to see his feet now. And then Brett fucking hardcore takes him down with a chokehold from behind. Very badass. And Doc helps him drag the body off screen. This is mega. This is crazy. Okay, quick note. His real name is Zephon, and he's the president, sort of Galaxy 5, right? Ring any bells? Any Douglas Adams fans out there maybe want to chime in at this point? Okay. Blammo. Doc has an idea. He's going to put on Shrubbery's robes and attend the Coalition of Kick-Ass's conference in cosplay. He also hands the reel to Brett Hammer and says that he found it in the jungle. Doesn't mention at all, mind you, that he found it resting beside a dead human being, but adds that it may not be relevant. And you know what? Soundbite. Yeah, soundbite.
I found this, and I don't know whether it's relevant or not, but hold on to it, safely.
Pretty sure the word you're looking for is relevant, Doc. Alright, so he's heading to the conference, the others are stealing the ship, and he's going to join them afterwards. We get a little cutscene of the Doc not knowing where to sit, but no one appears overly suspicious. Whatever, let's wrap up this app, I think. We learn that the Dalek's super weapon, the Time Destructor, is complete. It only requires the Terranium Core to be inserted. Lucky for them, Mavic Chen, who never tires of referring to himself as Mavic Chen, by the way.
I am Mavic Chen.
Has brought it. Cut to interior, Chen's spaceship, same time. Just like the comm center before, the cockpit here is like Alopecia HQ. Brett Hammer takes over. Blammo! Shrubbery Face regains consciousness and sounds the alarm. Quick note, though the Doc has removed his robes, Shrubbery Face is wearing, yep, robes. So I guess the assumption is he's like a babushka doll of, well, robes. Panic breaks out among the Coalition of Kick-Ass, and what does Chen do? He leaves the core on the table and apparently runs to the panic room. What? Obviously, Doc is gonna grab it and hurry out, and that is exactly what he does. But, in the spaceship, Brett says they're leaving without the Doctor, though. There is no time to stick around. Cliffhanger. 2 down, 10 to go, people. Episode 3, Devil's Planet. Guys, don't panic. You can relax again. The Doc makes it onto the ship. And they speed off. The special effects here are quite something, by the way. And rather than, you know, the standard Flash Gordon rocket ship, Chen's vessel looks more like a merry-go-round. Very cool. And we have a soundbite. 2 minutes, 14 seconds in, my notes say. The Daleks, sorry. The Daleks see them speeding off Kemble, and they ascertain that... That's fantastic. It's a Terry Nationism. Anyway, space extinction. Alright, so they don't fire though, because the commander says they need them alive. Doc gives a brief summary of what the Dalek master plan actually is. Namely, to take over the universe, first the Earth, then the solar system. Okay, and then what? Mr. Nation, you do realize the solar system is relatively small when compared to the entirety of the universe, right? But that's it. That is the plan. They're going to take over the universe, starting off with the Earth, and then taking over the solar system. This is what I said before. I don't think that Terry Nation knew the difference between solar system, galaxy, and universe. I think to him, these are all basically just synonyms for something meaning a gigantic amount of space. No matter. Doc also explains that you should never look straight at the terranium because a full M of it, as the core contains, is enough to make you go blind and or fry your brain in an instant. And Brett's like, that would take ages to mine. And Doc's like, hey, 50 years to be supplies. Soundbite.
50 years to be precise.
Thank you very much, Doctor. By the way, when you say something like, you must never look straight at it because it will fry your brain, I really wonder if someone's going to look straight at it. Anyway, blam. Back at Dalek HQ, Zephon Shrubface Magoo is being harassed for being such a massive, worthless idiot. Now, that pretty much summarizes the scene, but I'd like to point out that he reckons the intruders came from the solar system. It's inferred, even though they really don't explain which solar system, that they're talking about our solar system. So I realize I've already touched upon this before. I'm really sorry. All right, you know what? I'm gonna go back on what I said before. Here's what I think. I'm wondering, when they say take over the universe, do they actually mean our galaxy? Think about it. A, if they're taking over the galaxy and installing one Dalek to rule them all, then all the others who are heads of their respective galaxies, e.g. Zephon Shrubface McGillicuddy, would actually lose power. I mean, they'd suddenly be answering to someone else, right? And why would they go along with that? B, all of the planets mentioned in Mission to the Unknown are in our solar system, so clearly that's the focal point. But C, Mavic Chen, Mr. Politically Incorrect Makeup himself, is already the head of our solar system, so logically, one would assume that his ambitions are aimed slightly higher than so. It ests somewhere between our solar system and the universe. And we haven't been told who rules the Milky Way, or the other solar systems in our galaxy for that matter, so maybe that's the key. Maybe Chen's on board because he has a massive inferiority complex and wants not more, but in fact, just as much relative power as Shrubface and the others. You know what? Q-E flipping D. Think I just Sherlocked it. Okay, let's press on. Yada yada yada. The Daleks execute Zephon for negligence and then report that Doc's traveling circus is approaching the planet Desperos. I know I've been rather of two minds about this Terranation naming convention, by the way, but it's totally growing on me. I really like this. Okay, so there happens to be a tape player at hand, so they play the reel that Doc found before.
Oh, it's all so convenient, isn't it?
By the way, this time Doc says he found it next to a skeleton. But no one goes, what the shit, guy? Why didn't you mention that before? Was the skeleton wearing a uniform? Was it human? No one says a word about it. Actually, Doc does say that after a while, but that's a little bit later on, and only then does Brett go, oh, rad, you found Mark Corey. But that's not, like, he doesn't go, was there a uniform? Did you see, like, how do you know who this is? No one has any idea. He just sort of assumes Mark Corey. Okay, sorry. Now I'm looking at my notes here, and I'm realizing there's additional evidence to support my theory. On the tape, Corey says, the Daleks are planning the complete destruction of our galaxy. Blam! QED, the Milky Way, not the universe. Right? Right! And by the way, this message of Corey's does not correspond. It does not correlate 100% to the message that he recorded at the end of Mission to the Unknown. Anyway. Oh, okay. I am so pleased. I've figured this out. It's the galaxy. It's not the universe. They've made a linguistic stumble at some point. Does not matter. Why would they even bother invading, though? I mean, if they're planning the complete destruction of the galaxy, why would they bother invading the galaxy? Let alone spend time on Venus and the lunar colonies when they're destroying the whole freaking thing. Why is anyone's guess, I reckon. Anyway, gotta stop saying anyway. Brett is just explaining that they could get in touch with Space Security Chief Carlton, where when the Daleks flick on their so-called randomizer and then remote control the ship to land softly on Desperos while they send pursuit ships. Turns out, Desperos is a prison planet. This is pretty badass. I'm getting kind of Pitch Black vibes here. So, you know, ipso facto, the gang's pretty boned. Also, actually, wait, hang on. I don't know why this isn't in my notes. I just want to point out something. The Doc has not exhibited any concern whatsoever for having left the target TARDIS back on Kemble. I mean, they park the TARDIS. The door, for all he knows, is still, like, open. I mean, it might be closed, but it's unlocked, right? And then they just stumble into some spaceship, steal it, and shoot off into space. But how does he know when he's going to be back on Kemble next? He has no idea. He hasn't read the script. He doesn't know. So the TARDIS, the fucking most important thing in his life, is back in some jungle surrounded by crazy creatures. This is insane. Okay, meanwhile, Chen's heading back to Earth to pull some strings and get the authorities there to apprehend the gang, or what, to chase after them as well. Kerblammo, we cut to Desperus, where three convicts, Bors, Gorge, and Kirkson, who all look like Tom Hanks in Castaway, act out a little spiel to clarify that, A, they're essentially cavemen, though Bors has a knife, I suppose, B, that Bors is consequently in charge, complete with the right to decide that the two nondescript women in the sitting in a corner of the frame are going to stay where they are, and C, Kirkson and Gorge want to steal the knife to become the new leader. And this is essentially the Cave of Skulls from An Unearthly Child, as far as I can tell. But, gotta say, spoiler alert, this sets up kind of a little subplot for the episode, but it really does not pan out. Like, it is of no consequence whatsoever. Anyway, fuck, I said it again. Gorge now spots the spaceship landing, or the spa, as it's referred to. Everyone seems to call it that in this serial anyway. And the three of them head toward it, intent on escaping Desperus aboard it. Kirkson doesn't make it, though, and he's attacked by a screamer, which is basically an overgrown bat, and then he scurries back to their cave. Meanwhile, aboard the spa, Brett's repairing the controls, and Doc throws a power cable out into the swamp to create kind of a safety perimeter, and pow! It knocks Bors and Gorge unconscious pronto. The Dalek ship appears, and as it lands, they scramble to take off again, which they do, not before the Doc has opened the airlock doors, though, turned his back on the doors, and then closed them again. Wonder if that'll come into play. They speed off, lose the Daleks, and then we end the episode on Katarina screaming for her life as Kirkson pops out of the airlock and puts a choke and shiv hold on her. Shazam. 3 down, 9 to go, guys. This is epic. Episode 4, The Traitors. Okay, so Blammo, James Tiberius Kirkson, demands they change course. He doesn't want to go to Earth. Where does he want to go? Oh, I'm glad you asked. He wants to go to Kemble. Where else? And he just plucks this destination from the ether. It's as though there's really just one planet of consequence in this universe, and that's Kemble. If that's the first place that pops into anyone's mind, it's a wonder it's not crawling with space security agents looking for bad guys of genuinely every ilk. Okay, where were we? Right. Kirkson pulls Katarina into the airlock. Doc's already thinking, let's head back to Kemble. Let the Daleks deal with their hostage takers stowaway. And then Katarina reaches for the airlock button, despite having zero knowledge of buttons, as has already been established. And unknowingly, she shoots Tiberius and herself into space. Well, she didn't last long as a companion. I suppose losing companions ought to deserve a bit more pomp and circumstance, but you know what? Katarina ended her run on Doctor Who, conceptually, in much the same way I regarded her from the first moment she boarded the TARDIS, as a primitive hostage to be imminently flushed down the drain. Or the airlock, whatever the case may be. In the recon, by the way, we get a pretty creepy animation of her and Coxon floating lifeless through space. Very creepy. Check it out. Bing bong, I'm done caring about them, let's press on. So we get a cutscene of the Dalek commander chatting with one of the allies, Trandis, who's a dude who literally just looks like he has sausages, or perhaps boogers, stuck to his face. That's his alien thing, basically. Like, oh, how do we know he's an alien? What do you mean? Can't you see he has sausages, or maybe boogers, hanging from his face, even though apart from that he looks perfectly human? Oh yeah, sorry, obviously he's an alien. Not sure why I ever questioned it. These aren't prescription glasses. Silence, Earthling! Anyway, this is of no importance. It only sets up some dissidence towards Chen among the other allies, though, because Sausage Boogers is like, how the shit can we trust Chen? And the Dalek responds with, he has been promised even more power. And he also adds, not that it's of any relevance, but you know what, the Daleks are the best. The team, meanwhile, they're approaching a special research facility. I want to say, in the vicinity of, but not on Earth? Is that right? I'm not sure, actually. Let's make this podcast interactive. If you know the answer, leave a comment on this episode's page on whobackwhen.com and or tweet me the answer. I'm @Ponkin. You know how to spell that, right? If not, just make it up. Cutscene time again. Chen's now back at Alopecia HQ with the chick who missed the call in the beginning, and they're looking at a massive 3D image of the Bread Hammer. Very modern sci-fi trope, by the way. Well done, 1966 Doctor Who. So now Chen has told the Earth officials whom to hunt down, labelling Brett and his compadres the titular traitors. Actually, I guess traitors could refer to both the alleged traitors, Brett and company, and also Chen himself, who's a traitor. And all the... Oh my god, spoiler alert. I almost spoiled the rest of it. All right, anyway, blah, 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 blah. Let's press on. Get to that later on. We also learn that Mark Corey's original mission in Mission to the Unknown was carried out without official sanction. So that kind of changes things in my mind. Corey essentially was Bruce Wayne. Like, he was Space Batman, faking orders and using his influence to go be a space vigilante. Pretty rad. Cutscene again. Doc tells the new BS, that's Brad and Steve-O, previously Babs and Susan, not to concern themselves with him, but that the most important thing must be the Terranium. So, two things here I want to point out. Firstly, this is such a marvellous reflection of the Doctor in later years, and leaps and bounds from Season 1 Hartnell. Here, he's selfless and heroic, mysterious and almost omniscient, whereas before he was a Mr. Magoo asshole transporter accident. And secondly, why don't they just destroy the Terranium? Surely there must be some way of safely disposing with it, but what do I know? I'm no time destructor engineer. Okay, now we cut again. Mavic Chen sits behind a rotating desk, which must be the dumbest invention the future has in store for us, by the way. And then he meets Carlton, aka Dr. Evil, the main turtleneck guy from Alopecia HQ, and we learn that Dr. Evil is in on the scheme as well. And now they're planning... Dr. Evil, that's Carlton, by the way. Sorry if I'm speeding through this. Where was I? Yeah. They're planning to depose the other evil allies from the coalition of Kick-Ass, so that Chen can be the ruler of the universe. And he even manages to squeeze in another, "I, Mavic Chen!" In saying all this, seriously, by the way, if you had the patience and weren't in that big a hurry to get shit-faced, you could turn him into a drinking game. Does anyone ever do this? Does anyone ever say, "I, first name, surname, think this"? No one says that, except Mavic Chen. You know what? If there's time, I may include a little montage of just that for later on. Yeah, that might be a post-credit sequence. Okay, by the way, to any listeners with alopecia, my sincerest apologies, I'm only joking. Dr. Evil then calls ruthless space security agent Sarah Kingdom to catch the traitors, who have now crashed at the experimental station. Cut to the experimental station, where Doc and BS see no one, but are spied on by another dude with alopecia. And then we get Sarah Kingdom meeting Chen and Dr. Evil. Holy fuck, by the way, she is hot. Probably, and I only mention this because I feel it is deeply vital to the appreciation of this serial, the sexiest woman in classic Doctor Who so far. Probably hotter than Princess Tightbuns in the Crusades. Ruminate on that for a while, why don't you? Right, cold shower, back to the experimental station, which, by the way, is it a station where one conducts experiments, or is it fashioned in some newfangled manner that in itself is experimental? I don't know. No matter. Doc and BS are waiting for Brett Meister's amigo, Daxter, and Doc's already figured out Chen's plan and is getting suitably paranoid. And then, bing bong, Dax arrives. Cut back to Chen, Dr. Evil, and Sarah Perfect Ten Kingdom, though. Kingdom has been briefed by the diabolical duo and leaves, slowly, while Chen and Mr. Alopecia 1966, silent and drooling, watch her walk away. The doors close behind her, and they immediately agree that, yes, yep, they would. Blammo, on the experimental station, Dax, the only person Brad said would believe their story, first says, "I don't believe it," but then he does. And then Dax, the only person Brad said he could trust, is revealed to be a traitor through a Marinus-esque slip of the tongue. He says Terranium when he shouldn't know what the core is made of, whatever. So Brett kills him, straight up murders him, and Doc objects, saying,
"We have other ways and means of dealing with evildoers."
Really, Doc? Ways and means? I think perhaps you left out methods and manners. And what the shit, Brett? You just shot him. And Dax didn't actually even confess. He just used the word Terranium and then acted suspiciously. And at first, you didn't even want to believe that your friend was a traitor. You said you'd known him for years and years, but then you straight up murdered him. This is crazy. For all you know, maybe he just is familiar with the concept of a time destructor and, you know, logically assumes that one would use a core made out of Terranium in such a device. You have no idea. That's it, Brett. I'm not talking to you anymore. Okay, cutscene at Dalek HQ, where we learn Chen's plot to discredit his peers is working, because they're now saying that the fugitives are likely from the 10th galaxy and led by Trantis, aka Boogerface. Blam! Cut back to the gang. Enter Sarah Kingdom, toting a laser blaster and in as abrupt a manner as in Game of Thrones. Thrones, she suddenly kills one of our protagonists, namely Brett. Farewell, Brett. I shall miss you more than I will Katarina. Somehow, Doc and Steve see escape, though, and we end the episode on some actual footage of Sarah stunning Figure Kingdom, telling her fellow security gringo to aim for the head. 4 down, 8 to go. Episode 5, Counterplot. By the way, holy crap, these episode names, they are, for the first time ever, possibly, they are relevant to the actual plot content. And for the love of all that is good and pure in the universe, or the galaxy, or the solar system, Mr. Nation, take your pick, they are great names. Great, great episode names. Alright, let's go on. Episode 5, Counterplot. Doc and the Steve Meister run away from the crazy Hellcat, and into this strange room that just screams radioactivity or science experiment. I mean, I'm assuming that I'm sterile just having looked at it in this serial. There are even mice in there, like lab rats, so I wonder if Doc and Steve are about to have themselves a transporter accident. And by the way, that's literally the line I've written in my notes. It turns out I was pretty right in my assumption. Whatever, Doc cleverly deduces it may be some kind of experiment. Cut to some kind of experiment control room where two scientists are running some kind of experiment and start a 10-second countdown. Blam! Hottie McGunnuts enters the experiment chamber as well, and then all of a sudden, kablamatron, the screen goes all wibbly-wobbly, and Steve makes a face like he's melting. Doc makes a face like he's impersonating a fish, and Hottie McGunnut looks like she's enjoying herself rather a lot, if you know what I mean. And then, all of a sudden, we learn that the scientists were carrying out a molecular dissemination, which, yes, is a transporter. So, not only was I right, but now, Doc, Steve, and McGunnut are being beamed through space. And we get a fantastic little montage a la Superman of them floating through space. Weirdly, this only includes slow-mo images of Hottie McGunnut and Steve-Z, so one might presume that Hartnell is on holiday for this shoot. Anyway, I think it might be time to put in a scientist soundbite. Soundbite? Soundbite.
They're many light years from Earth by now, moving towards a strange planet in a strange galaxy, the nature of which we can only guess at.
Okay, so it seems to me like they weren't aiming their transporter at anything in particular. The scientists have no idea where the mice were going to end up. Seems rather sloppy to me. Either way, presumably the gang will now be somewhere they've never been before, right? I mean, of the infinity of the universe, they could land literally anywhere. There might not even be an atmosphere there. It might be so strange a place we've never heard of it before. That's my supposition, anyway. In the Dalek HQ, meanwhile, the Daleks are saying that Mavic Chen should be arriving at any moment with the Terranium. Okay, I'm not sure I said this before. Actually, you know what? I think I didn't say this before. But when we last saw the Daleks, they said he reckoned he'd be back with the Terranium in 2 days. Yeah? But there's been no time cut. Since Chen left Kemble, 2 days must have passed. But the Doc, Steve Z, and dear departed Breadhammer, they never rested, they never slept, they never ate, they never dropped a deuce in that entire time. Their constitutions are freaking top-notch. Okay, then we learn from another cutscene that the scientists were in fact sending the mice to a particular place. Not very consistent, this script. Namely, the planet Myra. And Dr. Evil recommends to Chen that he tell the Daleks this was his intention all along, because where is Myra exactly? I'm glad you asked. Out of the infinity of the universe, it happens to be really freaking close to the planet effing Kemble. WTFs are implied here, I think. No need to get into that now. Cut to Myra, where the gang has now materialized, although separated from each other, not from, like, limbs and whatever. Yeah, they are no longer together, is what I'm trying to say. They're not... Shit. They have all materialized perfectly intact within themselves, on their own, but not as a group. That's all I'm trying to say. Doc wakes up first, and he pops around looking for Steve-O, and Steve-O wakes up, he actually materializes next to Hottie McGunnard, wakes up, grabs her gun. And then, sweet buttery Moses, we see the alien foe of the week, or rather, we don't. There are invisible monsters living on Myra, and all we get are giant clawed footprints appearing out of nowhere in the ground as the camera pans across. Now, even though I'm assuming this was devised as a consequence of budget constraints, like maybe they couldn't afford or they didn't have the time, or either way, like the means to produce yet another alien costume maybe were not at their disposal. But even so, this is gorgeous. I mean, Boner level gorgeous. Although undoubtedly it's achieved with CGI nowadays. We see this exact same effect, the footprints, I mean, in any modern film with an invisible man or a creature or whatever. The recent Hollow Man springs to mind, for instance. Anyway, beautiful effect. Well done, Doctor Who. Alright, so Blah, 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 blah. The gang is now totally assembled again, and Horima Gunnar is waking up. Doc then explains the concept of beaming, or cellular dissemination as it's called in this universe. Quick note, he says their bodies were broken up into tiny bits and then shot across the fourth dimension. What? Doc, come on, we've been over this before. The fourth dimension is time, man. Get a grip. Cut to a Dalek standing by the mice on Myra. There's no time cut, by the way. This may be close to Kemble, but it's still a different planet, for God's sake. How did they get there so far? Darn those Daleks. Whatever. Pretty funny scene. They kill the mice as they may be hostile, but they still register something close by, and they fire a shot. We hear a wailing, and the Daleks exposit that there are alien creatures around that must be exterminated. Bing bong, we get a kick-ass scene of Doc beating the invisible shit out of one of the creatures. Visions, by the way, they're called, even though apparently they're 8 feet tall, and the Doctor is pretty tiny. And then we learn something even more interesting, namely that Horima Gunnar doesn't regret killing Brett at all, even though, dum-dum-dum, Brett was her brother. Wow. That's pretty cold. Horima Gunnar? that's pretty cold. Okay, blam. Cliffhanger alert. The gang is surrounded by Visions. Then we hear some Dalek firepower, and then the gang is surrounded by Daleks instead. And you know what? Let's soundbite the closing words of this episode. Soundbite.
I'm afraid, my friends, the Daleks have won.
5 down, 7 to go. Episode 6, Coronas of the Sun. Very arty-farty. Which reminds me, I've just finished the first 5 episodes. I think I've earned myself another drink. No Coronas in the house, unfortunately, so another martini will have to do. Kids, drink responsibly now, you hear? Yum. Anyway, this episode was now written by Dennis Spooner, as I said before, after an idea by Terry Nation. So that's kind of a good news, bad news kind of situation, I guess. In contrast to other reviews in which we've encountered the Spoonmeister, and I've just gone, I can't remember what he wrote, but I'm sure I was annoyed with him at some point. Fret not, dear listener, I looked him up this time. Dennis the Spoon Spooner, or Spoonmeister to you and me, penned The Reign of Terror, awesome. The Romans, amazing. The Time Meddler, classic. And episode 6 and 8 through 12 of The Daleks' Master Plan. Oh, and the opening ep of The Power of the Daleks, though according to TARDIS Wikia, he remains uncredited for that one. So those are all fantastic serials. I mean, well done, Spoonmeister. I think the reason I was annoyed with him at some point must have been that he was a script editor on some shit serial, but I couldn't find any data to support that theory now. Jesus, let's get on with the show. So, the first roughly 2 minutes of this episode are genuinely just a ping-pong game of the Dalek saying, hand over the core! And the Doc saying, up yours, Dalek, I'm not handing it over. And the Dalek saying, silence, hand over the core! And the Doc saying, up yours, Dalek, I'm not handing it over. And so on and so forth. Spoonmeister, you're off to a good start with this one. Then suddenly, the Visions attack in force, and the troop take the opportunity to escape while the Daleks kill all of the locals. Let's put a pin in that. Blammo! Doc, Steve Z, and Sarah, aka Horima Gunnar, now aim to steal the Dalek ship on Myra. And how do they do that? Oh, in the same manner as Babs did in the first Peter Cushing movie with a handful of sloppy shit, that's how. Except this time, Doc walks up to 347, who's single-plungedly guarding the Dalek spaceship, distracts him, and then Steve runs up and slaps a handful of mud onto 347's eye. Mega. Then they board the ship and spend like 3 minutes of airtime trying to get the ship to work while the Daleks do their best to stall long enough for them to escape. And then we cut to Mavic Chen being accused of incompetence by the Dalek commander and then reiterating much of his plan to them for the nth time. The news of the troops' escape reaches the Dalek commander, who says that they'll dispatch a rescue ship to aid the Daleks still left on Myra, whom he shall deal with when he has more time, i.e. presumably he will exterminate them eventually, right? So why even rescue them in the first place? Just leave them to rust and or be torn to shreds by the Visions. Meanwhile, though, the commander is personally taking charge of the hunt for Doc and the Double S. Cut to the Dalek ship that is autopiloting back to Kemble, where else, and where Doc plans to create a facsimile of the Terranium in order to fool the Daleks. I still don't understand why they can't just destroy it, by the way. Whatever. So two things. One, they deactivate the autopilot thingy, so the Daleks turn on a tractor beam, aka magnetized ray, to pull them in, except it'll take a while to take effect. And two, the Doctor's facsimile looks the part, with the exception of it not glowing with energy like the real McCoy. Steve has an idea, though, and he goes about trying it out behind Doc's and Sarah's backs, just as the tractor beam starts pulling them in, namely, by using the power from the G-Force engines, or whatever it was, to supercharge the fake Terranium, which he does, and his plan totally works. works, except he knocks himself out in the process. We get a Dalek cutscene of no consequence, then Stevie Boy wakes up again, but he's now encased in a force field of G-force energy and unable to speak. This is fantastically high-concept sci-fi, I think, at least for 1966. This is very cool. Anyway, then they land on Kemble and are welcomed by Mavic Chen and a force of Daleks. Doc still has the upper hand, though. He's not going to hand over the fake Terranium just yet. The Daleks can't fire at them, you see, while they have it in their possession, so he agrees to give it to them outside the TARDIS. Reluctantly, they agree. Oh, and Sarah manages to call Chen traitor, which seems to stun him significantly. Cut to the TARDIS, which Doc and Sarah enter. Steve Z hands the fake Terranium to Chen, and the Daleks will now immediately fire at Steve, but I'm just going to leave you hanging there, and instead return to a pin that I forgot to pop in the plot earlier on. So the Doctor said, listen, if you look at the Terranium straight on, you're going to fucking die. Like, it'll melt your brain and you'll go blind. Yeah? Not necessarily in that order. But when Steve Z hands over the fake Terranium to Chen, Chen literally looks at it, like, just with his eyeballs directed at the fake Terranium, sees that it is a-glowing, and therefore assumes that it is the real deal. But, okay, you could argue that the reason Chen doesn't get a melted medulla or oblongata is because it's fake Terranium. But surely Chen would have known that if he looks straight at it, he's gonna go bonkers and blind. So why the shit did he look at it? And when he does look at it and he doesn't go blind and bonkers, why wouldn't he assume straight away that it's a fake? Makes no sense. Anyway, let's get back to the plot. Steve Z hands over the fake Terranium to Chen. Chen looks at the Terranium, goes, this is the real McCoy. And immediately the Daleks fire at Steve, who still manages to enter the TARDIS unscathed. They dematerialize, and we learn that the Dalek weapons destroyed the force field around Steve. So he survived their attack and is no longer encased in a force field. This is fantastic. I mean, okay, I don't really know how he was able to walk around and hand over Time Destructor cores when he's encased in a force field that doesn't allow him to speak, but I don't care. This is fantastically cool. Interesting to note now as well, by the way, is that we're treated to what I'd like to call a conceptual Yeti. Steve goes, that's fucking amazeballs. With a tiny bit of calculating, we could construct deliberate force fields around us to shield us from the Dalek blasts. But Doc just disparages the idea as too dangerous or time-consuming or I don't know what, and we never hear of it again. But this is a great idea. This is such a marvelous piece of strategic thinking on the part of Steve Meister. Ah, Doc, come on! Alright, so we end the episode with the TARDIS landing somewhere with a poisonous atmosphere that is so unlikely, by the way. So far on Doctor Who, every planet and moon that they visit has the atmosphere of like an M-class planet. Anyway, six down, six to go, we're halfway there, I'm going to break for a cigarette now. I'm back. Episode 7, The Feast of Steven. Written by Terry Nation this time. Oh dear. Transpires, the TARDIS has actually materialized in 1960s England, outside of a police station, and is just picking up some smog on the scanner. Heads up, this is a Christmas episode, and utter nonsense. I'm going to speed through this one, because it's awful. I can't stress that enough. It is pure garbage. Let's see how quickly I can get through it. Time me, I dare you. Anyway, actually, I should say one thing. Trivia alert. So this episode, it was deemed not re-airable in a way because it would only make sense if aired at Christmas. And for that reason, when the BBC pitched selling this serial to the US, or abroad in general, I guess, I'm not sure, I think predominantly in the US, then what they had in mind was actually not a 12-episode arc, but an 11-episode arc that thus excluded Episode 7, The Feast of Steven. Because, I mean, okay, it is a Christmas bonus in a way, but it is also shit, right? So, presumably, and this is now taken straight from TARDIS Wikia, presumably there are two versions of the previous episode, one that ends on next episode, The Feast of Steven, and another version that ends on next episode, Volcano. Because, spoiler alert, that's the name of the next episode. Anyway, let's get to it. So, we go on. The Doc pops out to repair the scanner, encounters some policemen, dashes back inside and explains the situation to Steve and Holly McGunnut, then pops back outside for no real reason whatsoever and is arrested. We're almost immediately treated to an instance of the Doc breaking the fourth wall here, as there's a loon in the station explaining that his greenhouse keeps getting removed by rebels or some other twaddle. And the Doc tells him, as in literally looks at this lunatic in the face and tells him he's seen his face before. What do you say, 343? Soundbite?
Soundbite!
That's good, girl.
Haven't I seen your face before somewhere?
Hmm? Where?
Yes, of course, I remember now. Yes, the marketplace of Jaffa.
Because the guy, Reg Pritchard, is the same actor who played the merchant in Jaffa in the Doctor Who serial The Crusade. So this is crazy. This is the first time that Doctor Who serial dialogue actually refers to itself as TV serial dialogue. As in, like, it clearly refers to itself as a TV show as opposed to a universe in and of itself. Very cool, although rubbish. The Doc is now taken in for questioning. Meanwhile, Steve surreptitiously ducks out of the TARDIS and nicks a police uniform off the backseat of a police car. Cut back to the police station, and in steps Steve, sporting said uniform. Doc is at this point explaining to the detectives that he is a time traveller, and that the police box outside is in fact a TARDIS. What? Wow, way to keep a low profile. Cut to the TARDIS, out of which Sarah is now stepping and having a little culture shock with a curmudgeon policeman outside. So weird. And Steve, still impersonating a policeman, gets the Doc out of the station, and the three travellers then hop into the TARDIS and dematerialise. They rematerialise somewhere, turn on the scanner, and even though a moment ago Sarah even pointed out it still hadn't been repaired, it now works perfectly well, and on the scanner we now see a woman about to be brutally murdered outside. So, kablamo, out they all pop to rescue her, but they've actually appeared on a movie set, which they only realise after they've beaten the cameraman and the actors to a pulp. And then we start getting actual honest-to-God down-to-earth text plates a la silent movies before they bump into Charlie Chaplin and some other people on the set, including comic relief in the form of an eccentric director named Ingmar Knöpf, or spelled Ingmar Knopf, a Swedish given name, German surname meaning button, by the way, both very poorly pronounced. Blah, 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 blah. Steve and Sarah are mistaken for actors, Doc's mistaken for a man named Professor Webster, yada, 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 lots of running around, blah, 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 slapstick, loud noises. Then they're all reunited, and the Doctor spouts some mild racism. Soundbite? 343.
Soundbite!
Thank you. Soundbite.
This is a madhouse! It's all full of animals!
Loads more slapstick. Doc has a chat with Bing Crosby. Yada, yada, yada. They get back in the TARDIS and dematerialize. Then the real Professor Webster turns up, and he's an infinitely better Hartnell lookalike than the dude in Keys of Marinus and Dalek Invasion of Earth. And then, finally, we end this episode in the TARDIS interior, where the Doctor gives Sarah and Stevesy some champagne, I think, wishes them a happy Christmas, and then, I shit you not, turns to face the camera and actually says...
Incidentally, happy Christmas to all of you at home!
Which is insane. But apparently, according to TARDIS Wikia, again, sorry, I'm basically plagiarizing TARDIS Wikia for most of my trivia here. Apparently, this was quite common in the 60s, so around Christmas time, people in various TV shows, they would actually face the crowd, the audience, and just go, Happy Christmas, y'all. Well, with less of a fake southern drawl. And, yeah, they made no exception in Doctor Who. So, yeah, there you go. Insane. How quickly did I get through that episode? Pretty quickly, I think. 7 down, 5 to go. Episode 8, Volcano. Written by Dennis Spooner, after an idea by Terra Nation. The Time Destructor has now been fitted with the fake Terranium core, and Chen is chatting with Boogerface and a hissing dude with balls all over his body called Salation. Pretty much just saying as much, like just exposition. Cutscene! In the TARDIS, Doc can tell that they're being followed by someone. End cutscene. Cut back to Dalek HQ, where the Time Destructor is now being tested on Trantis, aka Boogerface. Trantis gets a little nervous, and Chen on the other side of a pane of glass goes, oh, so that's what's supposed to happen, a kind of abject insanity. What? Okay, A, wouldn't you be pretty nervous as well if someone pointed something called a destructor at you? And B, are we to believe that Chen actually has no idea what the Time Destructor even does? That is ludicrous. That's insane. Anyway, obviously it doesn't work. They realize the fault lies with the Terranium. Chen is quite upset, says it's the real deal, and that...
It came from Uranus!
Uranus. Kidding aside, the Daleks dispatch Mr. Hissyballs, send for a time machine from Skaro, and then exterminate Boogerface for genuinely no reason whatsoever. Cut to a cricket pitch where the two most dispassionate and dim-witted commentators are observing the TARDIS on the green. And this goes on for several minutes, them commenting on the cricket, until it dematerializes again and they completely disregard it. And in my notes, I have written, this is my entire note for this scene, cricket dash serious hitchhiker vibes here. And it's actually confirmed on TARDIS Wiki. I'm plagiarizing them again. In fact, you know what? I'm going to read it out loud for you. Hang on, give me a sec. This is what TARDIS Wiki says. Douglas Adams' third Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy novel, Life, the Universe, and Everything, contains a scene which bears a striking resemblance to the sequence in Volcano, in which the TARDIS materializes on a cricket pitch. In Adams' novel, a Chesterfield sofa bearing Arthur Dent and Ford Prefect materializes in the middle of the pitch at Lord's Cricket Ground, and two rather nonplussed cricket commentators discuss whether such an event has ever happened before, just as, in Volcano, two nonplussed cricket commentators discuss the equally unprecedented appearance of the TARDIS on the pitch at the Oval. Blam! QED. There you go. Thank you very much for verifying that, TARDIS Wiki. I'm not just going insane. Whammy! The Dalek time machine arrives at Plunger HQ on Kemble, and we fade to a volcano somewhere on the edge of which the TARDIS lands. And then, just then, a door opens in the middle of the rock face, and out steps Kerblamatron, the meddling monk, whom the Doc abandoned in 1066 in the Doctor Who TV serial The Time Meddler. Fantastic serial, by the way. Have a look at that. Have a listen to our review of that. I did the review with the Rollmeister. Blah, 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 blah. Doc, Sarah, and Steve Z disembark and trudge along, and in the meantime, the monk tampers with the TARDIS lock. And then they all meet, and he explains that he finally managed to work around the Doc's sabotage to his own Mark IV, and then he says he's marooned them on the planet, and we get a diabolical laughing montage as he leaves. Turns out, he essentially melted the lock, and Doc can't open the door anymore. Well, I'm sure that'll last forever. I mean, it'll take quite a while for them to break into the TARDIS, right? Yeah? Wrong. He focuses the sun's ray through his ring and onto the TARDIS lock, and Kablamatron, in and off they go, dematerializing before the monk's rather disappointed eyes. Well, that problem didn't last very long, and once again, the flipping ring is left entirely unexplained. And guess where we're heading off to next? Goddamn London in 1966, that's where. Trafalgar Square, to be precise. How come the Doc was never able to take Ian and Babs back to their own time? It seems to me, staying in early to mid-60s London is the TARDIS's natural state, in a way. It certainly appears to try to return to that state as often as it can, even by its own accord. Yawn. Not very exciting seeing London all the time, at least not when you're living there. Anyway, now we get a montage of New Year's Eve in Trafalgar Square and Piccadilly Circus, and at least a full minute of bells. which is my note here, anyway. Full minute of bells, thanks. Doc reckons, by the way, that the human behaviour in London at the time is akin to that during the relief of Mafeking. Nice to drop a historical ref here, Doctor, but maybe leave the Boer War jokes out of it. Thanks. Whatever. We end the episode on the Dalek time machine dematerializing out of Plunger HQ. Blam. 8 down, 4 to go. Episode 9, Golden Death. As I said before, this is another Spooner joint. Actually, they all are from now on in. The place? Egypt. The time? Ancient times. And the Daleks are speeding after them. In fact, we get another one of these annoying ones.
We shall arrive shortly in 4 minutes.
Why Earth minutes, Dalek 347? Shit. Okay, Doc is now trying to repair the TARDIS lock and says that the monk is probably not far behind them. Stevesy goes for a wander and then sees the Dalek time machine materialize and assumes that it's the monk. Off pop Stevie Boy and Sarah McFratricide while Doc works on, and we see an ancient Egyptian chap, Gorilla Dave style, spying on him from close by. Egyptian Dave runs off to fetch some reinforcements, and then Sarah and Stevie Boy see Chen and the Daleks exit not the monk's time machine. But Double S don't have time to warn the Doc Hammer because Kablamatron, it's ambush time, and they're captured by Egyptian dudes. And then we get a Dalek-Egyptian hoedown, and surprise, surprise, the Daleks are not taking any prisoners. Also, screenshot on the website, peeps, two of the strongest Egyptians in town pick up massive F-off rocks to throw at the Daleks. It's like they're on Asterix juice. Or possibly the stones are, or rocks are actually just made of styrofoam. Anyway, it doesn't matter, so Doc has now repaired the TARDIS lock and heads off to find his two buds, noticing all these gold objects there that are meant for the Pharaoh's tomb, and almost stepping on an Egyptian god who, despite being the only one on duty and despite there just having been a massive laser fight around the corner, is freaking sound asleep on the ground. What a lazy MF-er. Hope his line manager doesn't see him. Then, with a groan, a block of stone materializes next to him, and he hides as the monk pops out of it, sporting some kick-ass Ray-Bans. Steve and Sarah, meanwhile, are being kept in a hut someplace, tied up, but unsupervised, and Sarah's busy sawing through her bonds. with a piece of broken pottery. Blammo! While the Doc watches from his hiding place, the monk encounters Chen and the Daleks, addresses them as Daleks, in fact, and is at least momentarily spared by Chen, and subsequently ordered to retrieve the Tranium for them within 1 Earth hour. Fuck, that should be a trope. Okay. And then, while the monk, who... Wait, hang on. Why the hell is he still dressed as a monk? That was just a disguise he affected in 1066. Surely he's not actually a monk. He must have more clothes than his TARDIS. Makes no sense. Okay. While he heads off looking for the Doctor's TARDIS, Doc climbs into his and starts tinkering with the chameleon circuitry, and we get this awesome montage of the Mark IV changing appearance on the outside. Screenshots on the website, guys. Seriously, I'll have added screenshots ASAP this time. Of the Mark IV as a block of stone, a motorbike, a carriage, a wagon, a freaking tank, and a police box, presumably blue. And then, mischievously, he disembarks again, holding some sort of circuit in his hands. His own TARDIS, by the way, is now in the Pharaoh's tomb, having been mistaken for another gift for the afterlife, right, to the Pharaoh in his afterlife. Okay, whatever, blah, 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 you know what I'm talking about. Okay, cut to Double S, who have freed themselves now, Steve, Charles Bronson's two Egyptian guards, Sarah, Steven Seagal's another, and they escape. Blammo, Doc and Monk meet up in the tomb by the TARDIS, have a bit of banter. The Monk pretends to be a double agent and quote-unquote warns Doc of the Daleks, but pretty quickly changes his tune, and we fade out as Doc apparently bludgeons the Monk. The Daleks, meanwhile, dispatch a task force to apprehend the time travelers, plural, and then Sarah and Steve wander into the tomb to the TARDIS. Clearly, by the way, what the shit, Egyptians? Have you ever heard of security? Anyone can just waltz into this royal tomb and pick whatever golden treasures they wish, for Time Lord's sake. Ugh, I'll get over it. We end the episode on what looks like a mummy crawling out of a sarcophagus nearby. 9 down, 3 to go. Episode 10, Escape Switch. Not entirely sure what that refers to. This is the one exception that proves the rule. I don't really get this episode name. And this episode's fully intact and watchable again. Thank Ponk for that. Turns out the mummy is actually the monk, and Steve frees him from his bandages. They go looking for the doctor and, like absolute Nimrod, start shouting, "Doctor!" at the top of their lungs, so freaking obviously the Daleks turn up and apprehend them all. Even though, should say, when they were back on Kemble with, can't remember if the Bread Hammer was with them at the time, but they were having a shouting match, and no one ever heard them. But clearly, as a trope, being able to shout and, oh, sorry, not being able to shout, but shouting nonetheless and then being heard by the aliens, that existed fair and square back in 1966, so why it applies now but it didn't apply before, I have no idea. Whatever. The monk weirdly saves their lives here, claiming that he took Sarah and Steven hostage for the Daleks, and now they're all taken to Dustbin HQ, where 347 tells 348 that they've picked up, I think, the Doctor's voice audio? What the shit, man. I was hoping for voice video myself, but, you know, that's not all. 347 goes, "It's like 2 Earth miles away, dude, so we have that trope again. Come on, 347, can you give me that measurement in Dalek plungers, please?" Actually, you know what? No, wait, actually, here's what it is. Sorry, I got confused there. It's basically a tannoy. Yeah. Okay, they're hooking up Chen to the voice audio, and he's issuing a threat to the Doc, like, "We're going to kill these hostages unless you hand over the Tranium." That's what it is. Sorry, ladies and gentlemen, I got a little bit confused there. The voice audio, by the way, so dumb. It's a microphone that's stuck to a wall at pretty much at precisely Chen's mouth height. And he's a tall guy. So there's no freaking way this could be of any use to a Dalek. It's like the wall-mounted neck brace thingies in Dalek Invasion of Earth that were mounted at different heights to accommodate Babs and, what's-her-face, Balaclava. Anyway. Oh, gotta stop saying anyway. So he issues the threat, yada yada yada. The Egyptians think it's a voice from the gods, blah blah blah. Doc arrives outside the Dalek machine, requests that, and I quote, "The Daleks bring their hostages to the place of rendezvous and hand them over at the same time," end quote. But let's just clarify something here. They only agree where the rendezvous is actually to take place a little later. And I don't think they agree on a time at all. God, so dumb. So confusing. Where are we going to meet? I don't know. When? Oh, let's figure that out later on when we meet up, where we don't know where. Oh, this is so dumb. Okay, I want to include a soundbite here, not because it's vital to the episode, but because it does harken back to something we've discussed on Who Back When before. For example, when JD and I recently reviewed the Eccleston episode Dalek, namely... actually, you know what? Let's have a soundbite here, shall we? 343, what do you think? Soundbite?
Soundbite!
Soundbite.
"One Dalek is capable of exterminating all..."
So when the Dalek says this, Chen is actually quite shocked, and that's quite understandable, I think, in a way. This somehow excuses the phenomenon of one Dalek could effectively take over all of Earth, or at least exterminate all human life, as in the Eccleston Ep. But the Daleks are essentially a collective, right? I mean, okay, they don't have a collective hive mind or whatever, but I mean, they live all as one, more or less. So perhaps they act en masse solely because there are so many of them. I mean, if all they want to do is exterminate all non-Daleks, and one Dalek is enough to exterminate an entire planet's worth, then they wouldn't need to have orchestrated the Dalek invasion of Earth with thousands of Daleks, or had a massive army of them against the Thal on Skarov. So hitherto, we've thought, okay, maybe in Classic Who, one Dalek was not enough, and that's just something that was invented for the 2005 revival. But clearly, this was already on people's minds back in 1966. Oh well. Deduce from that what you will. Let's carry on. Doc retrieves the core from the TARDIS, drops his keys on the floor, picks them up again, and even though this was clearly just a Hartnell fumble, they kept the shot. Now everyone's heading to the rendezvous, including some Egyptian chaps who are planning to F things up for the Daleks. Double S are released, Doc hands over the core, and the Egyptians start rumbling and tumbling with the Daleks, which is an entirely pointless subplot, even though they appear to trap one Dalek, which surely must have had some consequences for Egyptian future history. You know what? At this point, I want to return to a pin that I placed earlier on. One pin that I actually remembered to place. Remember when they were first surrounded by Visians, then they were surrounded by Daleks, and then all of a sudden the Visians attacked as like a major force, and the Daleks started shooting them all down, and that acted as a distraction that permitted Doc and Co. to escape? That's essentially the exact same thing that happens here. This seems to be, in a way, almost the go-to get-out clause of this serial. Let's have everyone close to the end of a serial be ambushed, but then in order for them to escape to the next location for the next episode in this 12-episode arc, let's have the locals appear, attack the Daleks, get killed by the Daleks, while the troop escapes. That happened to the Visians, the same thing is happening now with the Egyptians. Okay, just a stray observation. All right, and then anyway, blah, 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 let's move on. Doc explains to Double S that he had to hand over the Terranium core to... I forgot about this. Hey, soundbite, guys. Soundbite.
I had to hand the real Terranium core over to Magic Chen.
All right, so Magic Mike and the Daleks, they find the monk's TARDIS now, thinking it's the Doctor's. The monk dematerializes, and we learn that the thingamabob that Doc removed from the Mark IV was the directional circuitry. So, A, the monk is now just popping around the universe aimlessly and weirdly materializes somewhere that isn't London in 1966. And B, with the circuitry installed in the Mark III, Doc and Co. can go straight to Kemble. The advances in circuitry might fry the TARDIS column, though, and we end the episode on Stephen pulling the main switch in the TARDIS and smoke coiling up. Cliffhanger. Will they all have blown up? Who knows? 10 down, 2 to go. Shit, we're so close I can practically smell it. Episode 11, The Abandoned Planet. Chen hands the Terranium core to the Dalek Supreme, and they set up what the Daleks refer to as the final conference of the Coalition of Kick-Ass. Why final? Oh, I have no idea. Could it be because the Daleks, you know, they plan on killing everyone? Well, if that's the case, maybe don't refer to it as the final conference in front of freaking Magic Mike. So the directional unit burned out. Doc says they failed, and then they see on the scanner that they've actually arrived on Kemble after all. So that's, handy, I suppose. Off they go to Plunger HQ, where we now see the final conference. There's Hissy Balls and the Thing from Fantastic Four, whom we met in Mission to the Unknown, and Mr. Springy Torso, what's-his-face, the alien accordion guy. And they all agree that Magic Mike should go F himself. Blammo, enter Magic Mike and the Dalek Supreme. The other delegates call out Magic Mike on his bullshit. There's a ruckus, and then Chen laser blasts a dude named Geron to death and declares himself in charge. Then suddenly the Dalek Supreme is left, and three regular dustbins herd off all the delegates, including Magic Mike, to some place where they shall await their own destruction along with the rest of the compound. And the Daleks now start the invasion countdown. Why? I'm not sure. Why not just start the invasion pronto? It's not like they have anything else planned as far as I'm aware. Whatever. Meanwhile, Steve and Sarah are making their way through the jungle with some sort of impulse compass that we've never seen before, and notice, A, that there are no Varga plants around, and B, nor is there any sign of the Doctor. They've just lost him. And he never said goodbye. He just popped off. There are loads of animal noises around now as well that we didn't hear a moment ago, and we have yet to see a single animal in this jungle, by the way. Anyway, they follow the power impulse compass to the Dalek city. The city is totally empty, though. No Daleks to be seen anywhere, and we get a great still of Steve and Sarah facing a corridor map painting that I'm pretty sure I recognize from the second serial, The Daleks. Very nicely done. They wander around, even reach the control room of the time machine, as in the Dalek time machine, but there's genuinely no one around, so they plan on entering the time machine and telling the Daleks that they'll steal the time machine and warn Earth unless they hand over the Doctor, even though they don't actually know for certain that the Daleks have him to begin with. Nor do they know how to operate the time machine. In fact, they locate the loudspeaker system, again conveniently located at a human mouth height on the wall, send out a message, and then realize they don't even know how to open the goddamn Dalek time machine doors. What kind of a shitty plan is this? Okay, Magic Chen and Hissy Balls respond on the intercom, telling them to rescue them. Turns out the delegates are all imprisoned in a cell that has been outfitted with a working intercom system. What the fuck is that about? What else? Double S wander on and find the cell now, and weirdly, Hottie McGunnut reasons that they need to release the coalition of Kick-Ass so that they can go and fight the Daleks themselves. What? They're war criminals. They planned on destroying the freaking galaxy, possibly the universe, maybe just the solar system. We don't know yet. And somehow, for no reason whatsoever, that I can tell anyway, Steve goes along with this. Absurd. Okay, the delegates all leave in their spaceships while Sarah and Steve look on. Then, all of a sudden, karmically, Chen's ship blows up during takeoff. And then, a Dalek appears, rolls into a hidden corridor in a nearby mountain, and Double S follow it, assuming that even if the Doc isn't down there, then perhaps there's still a chance to defeat the Daleks after all. Blammo. Enter Magic Mike, stage left, toting a laser blaster. And still very much alive and intent on being the master of the universe. Is that He-Man, by the way? I think that's He-Man. And then we end the episode on him leading Double S down the corridor at gunpoint. 11 down, 1 to go. Oh my god, so close to the end now. Whew, okay. Episode 12. Destruction of time. The last one, I can't believe it. How long have I been speaking? I'm gonna look. Oh my god, that's a long time. Alright, hey, 343, how long have I been speaking? Do you know?
Calculating!
No, you don't. No, you don't. Okay, let's get this over with. They head down the corridor. By the way, pretty sure Magic Mike is now darker than he used to be. He is in actual blackface and looks, if possible, even more politically incorrect than he did before. And we learn in a Dalek cutscene that there are 5,000 Daleks waiting for the invasion to start. This is, mind you, only, well, less than half of an episode after we've already established that one Dalek is enough to kill everyone. No matter. We also learn in the same cutscene that they've caught Magic Mike and Double S. Magic Mike, though, still thinks he's in charge, unaware that the Daleks are pointing the guns at him. He musters no less than 3 more. I, Mavic Chenz, realizes he's totally boned, tries to no avail to shoot a Dalek, and is then taken outside to be blasted to smithereens by literally every Dalek around. So Double S are now unguarded next to the Time Destructor for no reason whatsoever. The Daleks are so freaking dumb. Blammo, Doc appears from out of the shadows. He's just been hiding out, just somehow. Hands them the TARDIS key and says to return to the TARDIS. Then, after Magic Mike's been killed and the Daleks return, he activates the Time Destructor. And now, with the upper hand and temporarily using a Dalek as a shield, they leave with the Destructor because it's just like this tiny thing that you can hold in your hands. Steve Z heads to the TARDIS. Sarah sticks around with Doc. Again, totally pointless plot twist because they're all about to converge in a Mo anyway. They need to head back to the TARDIS to neutralize the Destructor, so off they go with Daleks in tow. The Time Destructor appears to be speeding up time around it, though, and Sarah's already visibly older than she was a moment ago. Stuff is changing around them, time is speeding up, and the weather is worsening, and now Sarah has turned into a freaking granny. Steve, meanwhile, is safe inside the TARDIS, pressing buttons for, you know, to no help. And then we cut back to Doc and not-so-hottie-anymore McGunnut, who are aging rapidly. Sarah is, anyway. She's looking like a mummy at this point, replaced by an elderly act in, like, caked in old-person makeup. Kemble is turned into a desert wasteland, so you'd assume millions of years have passed around them, by the way. So how, when they're right next to the source of the time destruction itself, have they only aged, say, 30 years? I don't know. Anyway, the Steve Meister sees them on the scanner, pops out to help, but finds that Sarah's already turned into a mere skeleton. Very creepy shot, by the way, of the skeleton turning to dust in the wind. Very creepy. And now Steve's starting to feel the effect as well. Doc, for some reason, forces him back to the TARDIS and then heads inside on his own. now looking completely fine, not even a speck of dandruff on his shoulders. Daleks now appear outside the TARDIS as well, and finally the Time Destructor Force is catching up with them too. They catch fire, they start to collapse and disintegrate, and a first in Classic Who, we see a Dalek in the sand, an actual Dalek without its metal casing. In fact, Doc even picks it up, screenshot on the website, people, and it looks not entirely unlike what we have in New Who today, I suppose. A lot smaller. It's like a little facehugger from Alien. And that's it. We have a tiny little bit of an emotional moment where the Doc goes, he looks around and he says, my God, it's like so many lives lost. Brett Hammer, Hottie McGunnuts, and for what? For nothing, really. And then they dematerialize in the TARDIS and all we see is the caption, next episode, War of God. Which sounds pretty epic. Oh. End of the Daleks' master plan. I need another cigarette.
Review.
Right, review. Okay, before I get into the actual plot of things, let me point out a couple of things. First of all, we got a new companion in the last episode in The Mythmakers. We got Katarina. She was essentially kidnapped by the Doctor. She joined the cast and crew. She was, I think this is a potential trivia alert. I'm not entirely sure. I think she was meant to be a proper new companion, but then they very quickly realized, no, fuck it. This is just, she's not popular or she can't act or the character itself has no potential whatsoever for, you know, there's no potential for longevity for this character anyway. So she was cut out. She was written out. So my first bullet point here is, oh my goodness, we just got a new companion, and in the most abrupt manner imaginable, she's just killed off. I mean, it's so dumb, the way that she's killed off. And, okay, you know what, fair enough. I wanted her to leave the show, but I think maybe killing her off in that way and then not really caring about her shortly thereafter, that's a little bit too abrupt even for me. Then we have Brett and Sarah. I'll bring them up side by side, because in a way, they then take over the role of second companion. I mean, Brett and Sarah, respectively. Brett obviously gets killed off by Sarah, and then she takes over the role again. And either one of these two is a much better companion than Katarina was, mainly because they can relate to the time and the place that the TARDIS visits. I mean, they can actually comment on it. They can interact with it. They don't go, wait, what? This is a key? I've never seen a key before. This is magic. How could they possibly have thought that Katarina would last? Obviously, Brett is a much better companion. Fantastic choice, amazing actor, Mr. Courtney, what an amazingly spiffing actor. I'm so pleased that we get to see him now in action before he is to return. I'm actually not entirely sure when he returns, if it's with, okay, people in podcast land are going to kill me for this. I'm guessing it's Pertwee, I'm not sure, but he is eventually going to return as Brigadier Lethbridge Stewart, well, Colonel Lethbridge Stewart, and then eventually Brigadier Lethbridge Stewart, if I'm not mistaken. So pleased that he's joined, so pleased that he is part of the crew, but then again, you get this, we have two alpha males joining the Doctor, who in himself, just because of his wisdom and his age and his just knowledge of the universe and time and space, he must take on the role of alpha. Having another two on board, that's simply too much. But then, do you have to kill off Brett? Can you not just leave him somewhere? That really, like, that broke my heart. Then Sarah turns up, she kills him, she turns up, she's immediately embraced as a new companion. Like, my heart and my mind are doing pole vaults inside of my body. This is, like, the weirdest emotional turmoil that the serial has put me through so far. I really enjoyed Brett. Then someone kills him, then I'm meant to enjoy her as well. And I did. I enjoyed Sarah as a sort of companion. And I had no idea that she was going to die. In fact, I thought she was then going to be the new companion, taking Katarina's place. But it's so unbelievable in a way. She kills her own brother and then within an instant regrets it, but she doesn't really verbalize that regret. Makes no sense. Fine. Companions aside, even though props to Steve Meister, he was fantastic in this episode, and he got to do a lot. I thought he was great. Peter Purves did a great job. It didn't feel like this was written for Babs. This felt like it was written for Steve. I'm assuming it was written for Steve, and it's just really, really good. Next bullet point, the meddling monk. I love the monk. He's such a great character, and I looked it up. I don't think he actually appears in Classic Who again, except he does appear in, I think, one novel, possibly graphic novel, and one audiobook. So I'm looking forward to going through that audiobook with JD at some point in the hopefully not too distant future. All right, monk, loved him. He was up to his usual monkery. That's plus points. The Daleks. Okay, difficult not to talk about the Daleks. This is the Daleks' master plan, but the Daleks, they really just kind of give off a chase vibe, as in the Doctor Who serial, The Chase, I mean. In fact, this whole serial is like this love child of The Chase and The Keys of Marinus, because it is, even though it is actually twice as long, it's as long as both of those two put together, right? I mean, they're 6 and 6, I think, so this is 12. But every episode has a different location, more or less. I'll get to that later on. It has an abundance of Earth locations, a la The Chase. It has some slapstick, a la top of, was it the Empire State Building? It has some slapstick with that, that's sort of paralleled in the Christmas episode, The Feast of Stephen. I don't know, I felt like the Daleks, they had this great idea, but they also have a time machine, which kind of blows their great master plan out of the water. Just use the time machine, guys, that's what it's there for, you're evil, you can manipulate time, do that instead. And what exactly were they planning on doing with this time destructor that literally just accelerates the passing of time? They were gonna fly with this thing at the head of their fleets into our solar system, one presumes, and everything, including them, would be affected by it. They don't have a way of shielding themselves to the effects of the time destructor. They would also all die. They would perish. It makes no sense. Their plan is pants. The Daleks are just standard Daleks. I like this one. I like it a lot more than I did The Chase, but it's still kind of standard Dalek fare in a way. Classic Dalek fare, anyway. That's all I'm going to say about that. Next up, Mavic Chen. Oh my god. There are two ways to see him. One is sort of the ridiculous, over-the-top, self-aggrandizing despot, or wannabe despot, who is just so theatrical, it's very difficult to even empathize with him or sympathize with him, even as sort of a bad guy. It's difficult to say, you know what? He's got an agenda. I don't agree with it, but that's cool. Go do it. I'll still root for the good guys. You can't do that because the guy he's like a parody of himself. But by the same token, you also kind of feel sad for him because he doesn't realize that he is never going to be the head of the universe or the solar system or the galaxy or whatever. He is destined to just be the guardian of the solar system. Actually, yeah. So strike solar system from the first paragraph. He is already the head of the solar system. He should just be pleased with what he has. He's done quite good for himself. Not everyone can brag about being the guardian of the solar system. What does he want more? What does he team up with the Daleks? Obviously, he's going to be double-crossed. But also, he had tons of people on his side. What about Colton? We never find out what happens to Colton. I would have liked to have seen sort of maybe a post-credit sequence of all of these space security agents arresting Colton and whatever other traitors there were in the Earth government, right? Doesn't happen. Next up, right, I alluded to this before. I've got a list of bullet points here, that's it. And I only have two more bullet points. Don't worry, people, I'm not going to talk forever. But the penultimate bullet point is the locations and times. So this serial falls a little bit flat for the same reasons as The Chase did. And that is that, I mean, oh my goodness, they have the infinity of the universe. They have a time machine. They can go anywhere and anytime they want. But for some reason, they end up on Earth. How many times? I don't know. A lot of times, right? In 1966, even. Like, that's just ridiculous. However many times they go to Earth, that's annoying. Then they go to Kemble a whole bunch of times. And then they go to Myra, which is basically just Kemble, but with Visions. It feels as though they could have done so much more, but they didn't, right? Why not squeeze in something else? Why not cut the Feast of Stephen and instead have... Oh, actually, that reminds me. I need to add a bullet point to my list. I need to talk to you about the Feast of Stephen. But yeah, why not cut the Feast of Stephen and add another time period? Like, it's something, if it has to be Earth, then make it something not directly relatable. Make it not slapsticky. Make it like a pirate episode or a medieval knights episode or a whatever. Like, oh, I'm at a loss. Anyway, the locations and times, very limited, kind of annoyed me. Next bullet point, fine. The addendum, Feast of Stephen. Okay, I had a poke around the interwebs. It seems as though it gets very mixed reviews. Some people think that the Feast of Stephen is like this welcome treat. It's kind of fun. It's halfway through, more or less. It's got a bit of humor. It's got a bit of slapstick. It's fun. Yeah, sure. I'll give it that. It is more humorous than the other ones. But it feels so out of place. To me, anyway. It feels incredibly out of place. And especially since when... I think at the end of Feast... It's either at the end of Feast of Stephen or at the start of Volcano. But I think it's at the end of Feast of Stephen. Sarah goes, oh yeah, I forgot about Mavic Chen. No, no, you can't do that. You can't ham-fist this slapsticky Charlie Chaplin episode into a very serious serial, an epic 12-episode serial. It's about death and destruction and the potential dismal plight of not just mankind, but of every civilization out there. You can't plunk in someone just, I don't know, slipping on a banana peel in there. It's really out of place. You have no right to forget about Mary Chen. That's why you're there in the first place. Gets on my nerves. However, final bullet point, the finale. Oh my goodness, that is impressive. I was blown away by the finale. The action and the suspense. I'm looking forward to listening back to my own review of this before launching it into the ether. But I have a feeling that when I got to that part, my voice, I must have just sped up. I must have just gotten completely enthralled by the plot and gone, oh my god, they're going there, they're going this, and then the time destructor is speeding up and people are aging left, right, and center. Like, it is crazy intense and so exciting. It's really well paced. Completely in contrast to the bulk of the serial. So and then on top of that, you get in the recon, unfortunately, because we've lost the footage, unfortunately, it maybe doesn't seem as dramatic as it was in the original, but oh my goodness, Loose Cannon did a fantastic job nonetheless. I'm imagining that the finale must have been so dramatic. I mean, we've only just got over the fact that Sarah killed her own brother, but then she just dies. She turns to dust. There's so much emotional turmoil at the end of it. It just ends on such a roller coaster, and it's so well edited that it blew me away. And on top of that, you have the special effects of her aging and then turning into a skeleton that then in turn turns to dust and blows away in the wind. It is fantastic. Bonus points for that. So, okay, in summary, I'm marking it up for kind of high concept sci-fi stuff, as in the time destructor accelerating time and whatever. I'm marking it down for Dalek stupidity, which includes the actual use of much of that sci-fi stuff, which makes no sense. I'm marking it up for the elaborate way of showing off Earth life and bureaucracy that is scientists and security and politicians and journalists and so on and so forth. I'm marking it down for the limited range of space and time travel. I'm marking it up for the finale, as I said. I'm marking it down for the over-the-top acting of Magic Mike and Hissy Balls. I'm marking it up for Brett Vian, who absolutely got me. He was such a fantastic character. And then I'm marking it down for the slaying of Brett Vian. I'm giving this serial 3.9. And we have some listener reviews. Listener reviews. Once again, I'm reading these out in chronological order. First off, we have Gallifrey and Buccaneer. How you doing, Gallifrey and Buccaneer? Hope all is well and rad and rocking. Gallifrey and Buccaneer goes, probably the toughest slog of the entire classic series due to the majority of episodes missing from this 12-part serial. I listened to the audiobook version with linking narration, clocking in at just under 5 hours. This sounds a daunting listen, but honestly, the epic scope of the entire story is something not normally seen in Who, and there are plenty of significant events in the story that keep us engaged. The most obvious is the shocking early departure of Katarina, a young woman robbed of any potential she had as she lays down her life to save the Doctor and co. Due to a mishandling of her character behind the scenes, we feel just as robbed at the potential she could have had as a player in the oncoming stories. Vian, played by the wonderful Nicholas Courtney, is a delight as always. It's great to hear, if not see, him acting alongside the original Doctor, as he would so many others, as the brilliant Brigadier. Jean Marsh plays Kingdom well enough, but honestly I found it difficult as a modern listener/watcher to see her as a companion, already knowing her horrific fate at the end of the serial. Well, you knew more than I did. Kevin Stoney, himself a fair veteran of Who roles, is fantastic in his role as Mavic Chen, for the simple fact that he overemphasizes and underemphasizes his speech pattern constantly. That's fantastic. I dislike him for the same reason. I love that we're not agreeing on that point. Okay, anyway, he goes on. Honestly, it has to be seen to be believed, yet it totally works, conveying his smugness over the Daleks and the Council. Later in the serial, we see this degrade under meddling from the monk himself, the Doctor, and the Daleks. He struggles to hold on to his power and, of course, is betrayed and exterminated by the trusty Pepperpots. The surviving episodes of the story are unfortunately tedious to watch, as the Doctor and co. hunt MacGuffins aplenty on how many damn jungle planets? Good point. Also, the invisible monsters of Myra, nice budget restraint there, Mr. Nation. It is nice, however, to be able to see see the monk once more in action. Completely agree with you. Buccaneer goes on, the Feast of Stephen is an oddity, but a welcome one. A fourth wall-breaking Christmas episode in the middle of a serial full of backstabbing, galaxy-saving, and extermination. The ending is fantastic, as Kingdom is aged to death in a barrage of sound and distorting visuals, hammering the viewer with a horror of a death come too soon. Even the Daleks are reduced to children in the face of the power of the Time Destructor. The last 10 minutes of the entire serial seals the deal. Stephen ready to leave the TARDIS as both he and the Doctor contemplate the deaths of Katarina, Brett and Sarah. A terrible waste, indeed. So is that it? Is that all the Dalek Master Plan gives us? Copious amounts of deaths, Daleks and destruction? Yes and no. There are the meddling elements of the monk to be enjoyed. The joy that is the Feast of Stephen and the potential of so many new companions. But potential is all they remain as death always wins. And that's what this story teaches us. The Doctor may win, but at what cost? Stephen is entirely justified at the end of this story, questioning the ability of the Doctor to save the lives of so many. The Doctor is fallible. He isn't a god. He can't save everyone. Perhaps he shouldn't. If he could, we would have the Time Lord Victorious that was so very wrong to see in the waters of Mars. Sigh. This serial is tough to talk about, as there are so many directions I could take this review, so I'll end it here. The trios of the Mythmakers, Dalek's Master Plan, and the Massacre is possibly the most important in the First Doctor's run, as it shows the Doctor as a character that can fail, and oh boy, fail is what he does here. Overall, with Mission to the Unknown considered, I'd give the Dalek's Master Plan a 3.7 overall. The high points of this epic story deserve better than the padding that surrounds it, and, as usual, it's a damn shame we can't see some of those high points. That's a fantastic review. I would like to add, though, that Gallifrey and Buccaneer has also included a PS. He goes on, PS, I finally got around to reviewing you on iTunes. Hope that helps. Oh my goodness, it certainly does. I literally just read your review on iTunes. I'm sorry, that's 2 weeks late now. I hadn't seen it before. Oh my goodness, thank you so much, Gallifrey and Buccaneer. That is tremendously kind of you. Okay, what can I say? Once again, you have submitted a fantastically insightful and well-written Doctor Who serial review. Thank you so much for sending this in, and you've once again also managed to open my eyes. It's so pleasing to me. I gotta say, I love the fact that you enjoyed Feast of Stephen, because I really didn't. But you make your case. I love that. I love that two bits. That is fantastic. I love the fact that we disagree on Mavic Chen. You really enjoyed his overacting. I thought it was terribly hammy, but you're right. It does work within the context of this serial. It is absolutely kind of in place, because he is an over-the-top character. I'm gonna stay my ground when it comes to hissy balls, though, because, oh my goodness, that guy really annoyed me. Gallifrey and Buccaneer, thank you so much for sending this in. And also, oh my goodness, thank you so much for your iTunes review. Ladies and gentlemen, you know what? I'm gonna read out his iTunes review as well, just to give you an example of what I hope and trust that you all intend to do at some point very soon. Gallifrey and Buccaneer says, very enjoyable podcast, 5 out of 5 stars. Thank you very much, Gallifrey and Buccaneer. Working your way through all of classic, new, and audio drama Who isn't an easy feat, as Ponkin is joined by co-hosts Flapjack, the Rawmeister, and JD down the road to, well, whatever the latest episode is when they finally finished. The hosts are fun to listen to, thank you very much, and are kind enough to read out any comments or reviews we listeners send in, obviously, adding a community sense to the whole thing. Definitely a recommended listen to all Who fans, old and new. Gallifrey and Buccaneer, I cannot thank you enough. That is so sweet of you. Thank you so much. I'm glad you're enjoying the show. I'm glad you keep sending in these mini reviews. Ladies and gentlemen, if you happen to not be Gallifrey and Buccaneer, I trust that you either already are, or within very short, will be following him on Twitter. And let him know what a spiffing review he sent in. He is at Alan R. Trussler. And just this once, I'm actually going to spell it, is at A-L-U-N-R-T-R-U-S-S-L-E-R. Oh my goodness. Alan, Gallifrey and Buccaneer, thank you again. Next mini review comes from Stephen. Steve Meister, how you doing, buddy? Stephen says, disclaimer number one, as with prior last episodes, I'm going by the audiobook versus the reconstructions. Disclaimer number two, the review is not mini by any stretch. That's okay, I'm gonna read it out in full anyway. Here we go. Stephen says, the Dalek's Master Plan is one of the biggest stories of Doctor Who in every sense of the word. It's the longest serial to date, coming in at 13 episodes total, counting Mission to the Unknown and Feast of Stephen. It also features several firsts, such as the first serial to feature Nicholas Courtney, the future Brigadier Alistair Gordon Lethbridge Stewart as Brett Vian, the first death of a companion in Katerina, and second with Sarah Kingdom, and the first ever breaking of the fourth wall as opposed to the fourth dimension. Very nicely phrased. Very nicely phrased, Stephen. Okay, Stephen goes on. The main plot focuses on Team TARDIS getting the essential part of the Daleks' new superweapon and doing all in their power to keep it out of their suction cups. In response, the Daleks prove once more that they are terrifying for, if absolutely nothing else, sheer determination. They are hounding the troop in one form or another during the entire serial, which gives a sense of tension throughout as our heroes struggle to stay one step ahead of the Daleks. While thinking of how to describe this serial without going into something as long as the serial itself, what I came up with was, this is what The Chase should have been. Very interesting take, Stephen. I'm very intrigued now. All right, do go on. He goes on. Excluding The Feast of Stephen, which I'll get into separately, there's not a great deal of filler as there was during The Chase, where you could skip an entire episode or two and miss next to nothing. Every stop, no matter how random, served some dramatic purpose, be it the shocking loss of companions, learning that no one can be trusted, finding a way to return to Kemble without the TARDIS, or even the monk's appearance in the second half, which slowed the troops' escape and provided a way to return to Kemble and stop the Daleks for good. Mavic Chen also provided a very interesting villain. While I use the audiobooks to get the whole story, I also have the Lost in Time DVDs with the still intact episodes on it, so I was able to see him for myself. He had a very interesting character design with his apparent racial mix and was quite devious as he kept both the Galactic Council under his thumb and himself in the Daleks' good graces. For modern Whovians, there's perhaps a certain, for lack of a better word, satisfaction in watching him go through all that he does while knowing full well that the Daleks will inevitably turn on him. I do wonder if viewers back in the day were expecting the sudden but inevitable betrayal, since being only the Daleks' fourth appearance and the first in which they collaborated with other species, they had not fully established their willingness to disregard any bargain as soon as it's convenient. Despite being a serious story on the whole, there were also scattered moments of humour. My personal favourites being the Daleks seeing the lab mice on Myra and declaring they may be hostile, and the cricket commentators when the TARDIS appeared in the middle of a match. Very nice. The mice thing in particular. Love that bit. Thank you very much for pointing that out again. He goes on. Then there's the Feast of Stephen. Feast is perhaps the only episode that could be called filler or padding. However, even this was done with a purpose, as from what I have read, this episode was scheduled to air on Christmas Day, and expecting people to spend Christmas with their loved ones instead of watching TV, it was decided to run a light episode separated from the whole of the plot to avoid anyone missing a part of the story they could otherwise have seen. That lightness was enjoyable too, especially as we see Sarah, Stephen, and even the Doctor utterly bamboozled by the 20th century Earth locales that they visit. It makes good use of the fact that none of the troop at this point come from modern day Earth, as this kind of humour could never have worked with Ian and Barbara on the TARDIS. That's very true. That is a very good point. And also good use of the word bamboozled. Like it. He goes on. That's not to say that the story is not without flaws. Due to why and when it was produced, I don't mark anything down for the Feast of Stephen. Okay. But there are other things in the serial I did dislike. To digress a bit, I'm a frequent visitor and contributor to the website TV Tropes. Awesome! You've written there. Very cool. He goes on. As a result, often think of tropes relating to shows as I watch, or, in this case, listen to them. The one trope that really stands out in this serial is sci-fi writers have no sense of scale. We have multiple galaxies apparently being ruled over by six people. The 8-9 planet solar system, propped up as the end-all be-all of intergalactic civilization, and the former allied against the latter in a grand example of overkill. It had something of a grating effect on me throughout this serial, though it seemed to taper off in later episodes, which notably seem to be the ones not written by Terry Nation. Very well observed. The audiobook credits episode 6 onward as written by Dennis Spooner, based on an idea by Terry Nation. Also, on listening to this story for the second time to help with my review, I came to the realization that the Galactic Council the Daleks form actually has no purpose whatsoever. They bring this grand council together with obviously false promises of power, but then dispose of them prior to even starting the invasion. Oh my god, I had not thought about that. I was perplexed at what they were even there for when it seemed outside of Mavic Chen, they did nothing to further the master plan except sit there and whine, moan, and hiss about how important they thought they were. Oh my goodness, you are blowing my mind, Stephen. I had not considered this. You are so right. They did nothing. They had no function whatsoever, and even if they did, they never had got a chance to act out that function. Okay, all right. Stephen goes on. I did come up with my own interpretation that seems to make sense. They were there to lure in Chen. Oh, very good. The council was nothing more than a way to stroke Chen's massive ego, bringing this organization together, making Chen its most vital member due to the Terranium, and letting him play petty power games when they didn't actively need him kept him compliant while he was useful. And as a bonus, they also gain whatever resources the Masters of the Galaxies bring to the table in the run-up to their invasion. To me, this explanation also makes Chen's breakdown as this ultimate of traitors realizes he's even less than a cog in the machine all the more gratifying. That is fantastically well observed. I also wish we hadn't seen Katarina go so quickly as she did. I really like the idea of companions from the distant past as opposed to modern day or future Earth or other planets entirely. My understanding is that the writers didn't know what to do with her, and I'd like to think, as a result, that the development of Troughton-era companions, Jamie and Victoria, is them having learned from their mistakes. The finale, as the Doctor and Sarah flee the ravaging of the Time Destructor, is one of those scenes that one cannot help but wish had survived to the current day. I even made it a point to find the recon just for that scene. It looked like it could have been impressive even by recent sci-fi standards. Very true. He concludes, finally, rating. I'm giving The Daleks' Master Plan a 4.6 out of 5. I'm an absolute sucker for epic scale storylines such as this. Between them, Brett Vian, Sarah Kingdom, the Monk, and Mavic Chen provide us a good secondary cast, and the Daleks, more than in any of their last appearances, are established for decades to come. There were flaws, as described already. However, I'm generally forgiving of them in this era of science fiction unless they actively interfere with my ability to enjoy the show, and the only one that did that, the solar system scale issue, largely corrects itself through the course of the story. And he adds a little asterisk at the end. You can find the trope I mentioned earlier at, and then a URL. I will add a link to that in the show notes. In fact, this whole mini, obviously, just as Gallifreyan Buccaneers, they're going onto the website. You'll find the link there. Check it out. I will. Thank you so much, Stephen. Steve Meister, Steve Aruni. I feel like we're close enough now. I feel like I can call you these things. Steve, thank you so much for sending in your review. 2 for 2. This is another incredibly insightful review. And I think I may have exhausted my daily allocation of oh my goodnesses, but holy moly, your theory makes perfect sense. I had not considered this at all. You're right. Obviously, the Daleks just used all the other members of Coalition Kick-Ass to lure Chen in. I am impressed. I am very impressed. Ladies and gentlemen, if you are equally as impressed as I am, then please let Steven know. He is at sgamer82. That's 82 the number. Follow him on Twitter. Thank him for his spiffing review. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm not entirely sure how long I've been talking at you, but it turns out I have not been talking at you for as long as I may have feared, so this is not going up as a double episode as I think you may have gathered by now. Thank you so much for listening. If you've listened to just me this far, imagine how much you would enjoy listening to me talking with someone else. There are plenty of Classic Who reviews that I've done with Flapjack and the Rawmeister. There are plenty of Audio Who reviews and New Who reviews that I've done with JD. He is fantastic and a freaking encyclopedia of Who. You're going to love those episodes if you don't love them already. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to us on iTunes. Rate us on iTunes like Gallifreyan Buccaneer. Thanks again, Alan. Check us out on Facebook. We're facebook.com/whobackwhen, all in one word. And if you like us there, then you'll get regular updates about new episodes and whatever else we might have going on. And you know what? If you enjoyed listening to me, you might enjoy reading some of my thoughts as well. Hit me up on Twitter. Send me a virtual high five and a hello, and I will probably high five you right back. I am at Ponken, P-O-N-K-E-N. That's the only time I'm spelling that. Never spelling that again. From here on in, you're going to have to figure it out on your own. And obviously, check out whobackwhen.com, where we have an ever-growing visual index of aliens and allies and companions, and there are going to be nemeses on there within very short, and we've got tons of stuff, historical characters. It's crazy, this thing is growing. Ladies and gentlemen, once again, thank you so much for listening. I've been Ponken. It's been a pleasure. Be rad and excellent to each other, and I will catch you in the next episode. Shamalama ding dong, rock on, and cha ciao.
Who back when?
Methinks it's time for a post-credit sequence.
I am Mavic Chen.
Then it'll be me, Mavic Chen, who'll be next in line.
And you had the audacity to accuse me, Mavic Chen, of incompetence.
You, Mavic Chen, will wait here. Mavic Chen, representative from the solar system, will address the meeting.
But I, Mavic Chen, was solely responsible for the recovery of the core of the Time Destructor.
Once again, I, Mavic Chen, guardian of the solar system, have helped the Daleks with their conquest plan. I, Mavic Chen, will decide when the alliance is at an end.
I, Mavic Chen!